Once Chicago was selected, Judd, a railway lawyer, persuaded the railroad companies to provide a cheap excursion rate from all parts of the state, so that lack of funds would not keep Lincoln supporters from attending the convention. Concealed from his rivals, Lincoln had taken an important step toward the nomination. So confident were Seward's friends about his chances that they had no problem with the Chicago selection. "I like the place and the tenor of the call," New York editor John Bigelow wrote Seward at the time. "I do not see how either could be bettered, nor how it is possible to take exception to it." But Charles Gibson, Bates's friend and supporter, was not so sanguine. He recognized that it was a blow to the Bates candidacy. "Had the convention been held in St. Louis," Gibson later wrote, "Lincoln would not have been the nominee." As Lincoln's candidacy became a real prospect, he attended to the request made by Jesse Fell a year earlier for a short history of his life to be published and distributed. After warning Fell that "there is not much of it, for the reason, I suppose, that there is not much of me," Lincoln detailed, without a hint of self-pity, the facts of his early life, growing up in a wild region with many bears and other wild animals still in the woods. "If anything be made out of it, I wish it to be modest," Lincoln told Fell. "Of course, it must not appear to have been written by myself." This simple sketch, written in his own hand, would be used later in Republican efforts to romanticize Lincoln's humble beginnings. Lincoln's hopes for making himself better known outside the West received an immense boost when he received the invitation from Chase supporter James Briggs to speak as part of a lecture series in Brooklyn. The lecture was eventually scheduled for February 27, 1860. Chase, as we saw, had declined the opportunity to speak in the same series, despite word that its organizers were men seeking an alternative to Seward. Upon his arrival in New York, Lincoln sought out Henry Bowen, editor of the anti-slavery New York Independent, who had helped arrange the event. "His clothes were travel-stained, and he looked tired and woebegone," Bowen recalled. "In this first view of him, there came to me the disheartening and appalling thought of the great throng which I had been so instrumental in inducing to come." But Bowen's initial impression of Lincoln softened after Lincoln admitted that the long journey had worn him out, and said, "If you have no objection, I will lie down on your lounge here, and you can tell me about the arrangements for Monday night." At the Astor House, Lincoln met Mason Brayman, a fellow lawyer who had lived in Springfield for some years before returning to his native New York. "Well, B., how have you fared since you left Illinois?" Lincoln asked. "I have made $100,000 and lost all," Brayman ruefully replied. "How is it with you, Mr. Lincoln?" "Oh, very well," Lincoln said. "I have the cottage at Springfield, and about $8,000 in money. If they make me vice president with Seward, as some say they will, I hope I shall be able to increase it to $20,000. And that is as much as a man ought to want." Lincoln's sights, however, were not trained on the vice presidency, and politics, not riches, were his object. That February afternoon, Lincoln paid a visit to the studio of the photographer Matthew Brady on Broadway. When Brady was posing him, he urged Lincoln to hike up his shirt collar. Lincoln quipped that Brady wanted to shorten his neck. The resulting three-quarter-length portrait shows the 51-year-old Lincoln standing before a pillar, the fingers of his left hand spread over a book. Prominent cheekbones cast marked shadows across his clean-shaven face. The delicate, long bow of his upper lip contrasts with the full lower lip, and the deep-set gaze is steady and melancholy. This photograph, circulated widely in engravings and lithographs in the Northeast, was the first arresting image many would see of Abraham Lincoln. Nearly 1,500 people came to hear this Western man speak in the Great Hall at Cooper Union. He had bought a new black suit for the occasion, but it was badly wrinkled from the trip. An observer noticed that one of the legs of his trousers was up about 2 inches above his shoe. His hair was disheveled and stuck out like rooster's feathers. His coat was altogether too large for him in the back, his arms much longer than his sleeves. Yet once he began to speak, people were captivated by his earnest and powerful delivery. Lincoln had labored to craft his address for many weeks, extensively researching the attitudes of the Founding Fathers toward slavery. He took as the text for his discourse a speech in which Senator Douglas had said of slavery, "Our fathers, when they framed the government under which we live, understood this question just as well and even better than we do now." Fully endorsing this statement, Lincoln examined the beliefs and actions of the founders, concluding that they had marked slavery as an evil not to be extended, but to be tolerated and protected only because of and so far as its actual presence among us makes that toleration and protection a necessity. In the preceding months, tensions between North and South had continued to escalate, with each section joining in a hue and cry against the other. The troubling scenario that Lincoln had observed nearly 2 decades earlier, during the battle over temperance, had come to pass. Denunciation was being met by denunciation. Crimination with crimination, and anathema with anathema. To have expected either side to respond differently once the rhetoric had heated up, Lincoln warned during that earlier battle, was to expect a reversal of human nature, which is God's decree, and never can be reversed. At Cooper Union, as he had done in his celebrated Peoria speech 6 years earlier, Lincoln attempted to cut through the rancor of the embattled factions by speaking directly to the Southern people. While his faith in Southern responsiveness had seriously dimmed by this time, he hoped the fear and animosity of slaveholders might be assuaged if they understood that the Republicans desired only a return to the old policy of the fathers, so the peace of the old times could once more be established. Denying charges of sectionalism, he said Republicans were the true conservatives, adhering to the old and tried against the new and untried. Turning to his fellow Republicans, he entreated, "Let us do nothing through passion and ill temper. Even though the Southern people will not so much as listen to us, let us calmly consider their demands, and yield to them, if in our deliberate view of our duty we possibly can." Though the approach was moderate, Lincoln spoke with such passion and certainty about the unifying principle of the Republican Party, never to allow slavery to spread into the national territories and to overrun us here in these free states, that even the most radical Republicans in the audience were captivated. When he came to the dramatic ending pledge, "Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it," the audience erupted in thunderous applause. After Lincoln spoke, several of the event organizers took the platform. Chase supporter James Briggs predicted that "one of three gentlemen will be our standard-bearer: William Henry Seward, Salmon Chase, or the gallant son of Kentucky who was reared in Illinois and whom you have heard tonight." Lincoln's still unannounced candidacy had taken an enormous step forward. "When I came out of the hall," one member of the audience said, my face glowing with an excitement and my frame all a-quiver, "a friend, with his eyes aglow, asked me what I thought of Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter. I said, 'He's the greatest man since St. Paul.'" Once the speech was reported in the papers, Lincoln was in demand across New England. He answered as many requests as possible, undertaking an exhausting tour of New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, repeating and modifying the arguments of his Cooper Union address. He was forced to decline invitations from outside New England, but hoped to visit New Jersey and Pennsylvania before the fall elections. Writing to Mary from Exeter Academy in New Hampshire, where their son Robert was completing a preparatory year before entering Harvard College, Lincoln admitted that the Cooper Union speech, being within my calculation before I started, went off passably well and gave me no trouble whatever. The difficulty was to make 9 others before reading audiences who had already seen all my ideas in print. In Hartford, Connecticut, on March 5th, Lincoln first met Gideon Wells, an editorial writer for the Hartford Evening Press, who would become his Secretary of the Navy. Arriving by train in the afternoon, Lincoln had several hours to spare before his speech that evening. He walked up Asylum Street to the bookstore of Brown and Gross, where he encountered the 58-year-old Wells, a peculiar-looking man with a curly wig perched on his outsized head and a flowing white beard. Wells had attended Norwich University and studied the law, but then devoted himself to writing, leaving the legal profession at 24 to take charge of the Democratic Hartford Times. A strong supporter of Andrew Jackson, Wells had represented his town of Glastonbury in the state legislature for 8 years. He remained a loyal Democrat until the mid-50s, when he became troubled by his affiliation to the Party of the Southern Slavocracy. Like many anti-slavery Democrats, he joined the Republican Party, though he still held fast to the frugal fiscal policies of the Democrats. With the convention only 2 months away, Wells had settled on Chase, whom he had met 4 years earlier while visiting Cincinnati. While Wells held less radical views on slavery, he was comforted by Chase's similar sentiments regarding government spending and states' rights. Seward, by contrast, frightened Wells. For years, the former Whig and the former Democrat had been at loggerheads over government spending. Wells was convinced that Seward belonged to the New York school of very expensive rulers. Moreover, Wells was appalled by Seward's talk of a higher law than the Constitution, and his predictions of an irrepressible conflict. He was ready to support any candidate but Seward, despite the fact that Seward was the most popular among the Republicans. That afternoon, Lincoln and Wells spent several hours conversing on a bench in the front of the store. Wells had read accounts of Lincoln's debates with Douglas and had noted the extravagant reviews of his Cooper Union speech. There is no record of their conversation that day, but the Prairie lawyer left a strong imprint on Wells, who watched that evening as he delivered a 2-hour speech before an overflowing crowd at City Hall. Though he retained much of his Cooper Union speech, Lincoln developed a new metaphor in Hartford to perfectly illustrate his distinction between accepting slavery where it already existed while doing everything possible to curtail its spread. Testing his image in Hartford, he would refine it further in subsequent speeches. "If I saw a venomous snake crawling in the road," Lincoln began, "any man would say I might seize the nearest stick and kill it. But if I found that snake in bed with my children, that would be another question. I might hurt the children more than the snake, and it might bite them. But if there was a bed newly made up, to which the children were to be taken, and it was proposed to take a batch of young snakes and put them there with them, I take it no man would say there was any question how I ought to decide. The new territories are the newly made bed to which our children are to go, and it lies with the nation to say whether they shall have snakes mixed up with them or not." The snake metaphor acknowledged the constitutional protection of slavery where it legally existed, while harnessing the protective instincts of parents to safeguard future generations from the venomous expansion of slavery. This homely vision of the territories as beds for American children exemplified what James Russell Lowell described as Lincoln's ability to speak as if the people were listening to their own thinking out loud. When Seward reached for a metaphor to dramatize the same danger, he warned that if slavery were allowed into Kansas, his countrymen would have introduced the Trojan horse into the new territory. Even if most of his classically trained fellow senators immediately grasped his intent, the Trojan horse image carried neither the instant accessibility of Lincoln's snake-in-the-bed story nor its memorable originality. The morning after his City Hall speech, Lincoln met with Welles again in the office of the Hartford Evening Press. When they parted after an hour of discussion, Welles was favorably impressed. "This orator and lawyer has been caricatured. He is not Apollo, but he is not Caliban," he wrote in the next edition of his paper. "He is in every way large, brain included, but his countenance shows intellect, generosity, great good nature, and keen discrimination. He is an effective speaker because he is earnest, strong, honest, simple in style, and clear as crystal in his logic." Preparing to return to Springfield, Lincoln had accomplished more than he ever could have anticipated. No longer the distant frontiersman, he had made a name in the East. His possible candidacy was now widely discussed. "I have been sufficiently astonished at my success in the West," Lincoln told a Yale professor who had praised his speech highly. "But I had no thought of any marked success at the East, and least of all that I should draw out such commendations from literary and learned men." When James Briggs told him, "I think your chance for being the next president is equal to that of any man in the country," Lincoln responded, "When I was East, several gentlemen made about the same remarks to me that you did today about the presidency. They thought my chances were about equal to the best." Now there was work to be done at home. A successful bid would require the complete support of the Illinois delegation. To accomplish this, Lincoln would need to bridge the often rancorous divisions within the Republican ranks, a task that would demand all his ample and subtle political skills. At the end of January 1859, Lyman Trumbull, concerned that the increasingly popular Lincoln might contest his re-election to the Senate, had apprised him of an article said to have been prepared by Colonel John Wentworth, the Republican mayor of Chicago, the object of which evidently is to stir up bad feeling between Republicans who were formerly Whigs and those who were Democrats. The piece suggested bad faith on the Democrats' part, singling out Norman Judd and Trumbull himself in 1855 and again in 1858, when Lincoln ran a second time against Douglas. "Any effort to put enmity between you and me," Lincoln reassured Trumbull, "is as idle as the wind. The Republicans generally, coming from the old Democratic ranks, were as sincerely anxious for my success in the late contest as I myself. And I beg to assure you, beyond all possible cavil, that you can scarcely be more anxious to be sustained 2 years hence than I am that you shall be so sustained. I cannot conceive it possible for me to be a rival of yours." "A word now for your own special benefit," Lincoln warned in a follow-up note. "You better write no letters which can possibly be distorted into opposition or quasi-opposition to me. There are men on the constant watch for such things, out of which to prejudice my peculiar friends against you. While I have no more suspicion of you than I have of my best friend living, I am kept in a constant struggle against suggestions of this sort." It would require more effort to defuse the increasingly bitter feud between Norman Judd and John Wentworth. In public forums, Wentworth would drag out past wrongs, continuing to accuse Judd and his former Democratic allies of conspiring to defeat Lincoln in 1855, of bungling Lincoln's campaign in 1858, and of working now to advance Trumbull as a presidential candidate at Lincoln's expense. Lincoln hastened to reassure Judd, who hoped to run for governor, that the vague charge that you played me false last year I believe to be false and outrageous. In 1855, you did vote for Trumbull against me, and although I think, and have said 1,000 times, that was no injustice to me, I cannot change the fact, nor compel people to cease speaking of it. Ever since that matter occurred, I have constantly labored, as I believe you know, to have all recollection of it dropped. Finally, as to the charge of your intriguing for Trumbull against me, I believe as little of that as any other charge. If such charges were made, Lincoln promised, they would not go uncontradicted. The controversy erupted into public view when Judd brought a libel suit against Wentworth, who tried to retain Lincoln as his counsel, claiming that the very reason that you may assign for declining my offer is the very one that urges me to write you. You are friendly to us both. I prefer to put myself in the hands of mutual friends rather than in the hands of those who have a deep interest in keeping up a quarrel. Of course, Lincoln had no intention of entangling himself in such explosive litigation, but he did help to mediate the altercation. The dispute was resolved without a court fight. Consequently, both Wentworth and Judd remained close to Lincoln and would support his efforts to control the Illinois delegation. I am not in a position where it would hurt much for me to not be nominated on the national ticket, but I am where it would hurt some for me to not get the Illinois delegation, Lincoln wrote Judd, knowing that the former Democrat had influence with the Chicago Press and Tribune, which covered the northern part of the state. Can you not help me a little in this matter, in your end of the vineyard? A week later, the Tribune published a resounding editorial on behalf of Lincoln's candidacy. You saw what the Tribune said about you, Judd said to Lincoln. Was it satisfactory? On May 10, 1860, the Illinois State Republicans assembled in Decatur, buoyed by the noisy enthusiasm his candidacy elicited at the state convention. Lincoln nonetheless recognized that some of the delegates chosen to go to the national convention, though liking him, probably favored Seward or Bates. To head off possible desertions, Lincoln's friends introduced a resolution on the second day of the meeting. That Abraham Lincoln is the choice of the Republican Party of Illinois for the presidency, and the delegates from this state are instructed to use all honorable means to secure his nomination by the Chicago Convention and to vote as a unit for him. With the Republican National Convention set to begin the following week, Lincoln could rest easy in the knowledge that he had used his time well, though he often claimed to be a fatalist, declaring that what is to be will be, and no prayers of ours can reverse the decree. His diligence and shrewd strategy in the months prior to the convention belied his claim. More than all his opponents combined, the country lawyer and local politician had toiled skillfully to increase his chances to become the Republican nominee for president. Chapter 8. Showdown in Chicago. 40,000 visitors descended upon Chicago in the middle of May 1860, drawn by the festive excitement surrounding the Republican National Convention. Dozens of trains, mechanical marvels of the age, carried the delegates and supporters of America's youngest political party to America's fastest-growing city. All along the routes, as trains roared past the Niagara, up across the majestic Ohio River, and troubled the air of the western frontier, crowds gathered at every bunting-draped station, sounding their enthusiasm for the Republican cause with brass bands and volleys of cannon fire. Even at crossroads, reporters observed, Small groups were assembled to lend their countenances to the occasion, and from farmhouses the ladies waved their kerchiefs, and farmers in the fields swung their hats. Of all the trains bound for Chicago, none attracted more attention than the one that began its journey at the Suspension Bridge in Buffalo, New York, and swept to Chicago in an astonishing record time of 16 hours. The unprecedented speed of the massive train was said to amaze every passenger. A reporter recalled that when 1 mile a minute was accomplished, the boldest held his breath, and the timid ones trembled in their boots. Every seat was occupied. In addition to delegates, the train carried dozens of newspaper men, professional applauders, henchmen, office seekers, and prize fighters hired to keep the peace, recalled one young passenger, for in those hot days men's opinions often cost them broken heads. Amenities included a carload of such refreshments, one reporter noted, as lead inevitably to the conclusion that the majority of delegates are among the opponents of temperance laws. With boosterish pride, young Chicago was determined to show its best face to the world during the convention. Chicago's growth in previous decades had been almost ridiculous, a contemporary magazine suggested. Indeed, growth is much too slow a word. An English visitor marveled, to describe the explosion Chicago had experienced since an 1830 guidebook depicted a military post and fur station, with wolves prowling the streets at night, and a meager population of 12 families who would bunk together in the town's well-defended fort for safety each winter. 30 years later, Chicago boasted a population of more than 100,000, and the distinction of being the first grain market in the world, surpassing not only Odessa, the great grain market of Russia, but all of Europe. It had supplanted St. Louis as the chief marketplace for the vast herds of cattle that grazed the northwest prairies, and had become the first lumber market in the world. Newcomers to the bustling city were dazzled by its miles of wharves crowded with shipping, long lines of stately warehouses, and crowds of men busy in the active pursuit of trade. Only recently, its streets had been raised from the mud and water by a bold decision to elevate every building and roadway to a level of 12 feet above Lake Michigan. "Our city has been chosen, here to throw to the winds the broad banner of republicanism," the Press and Tribune proclaimed, "and here to name the leader who shall lead all our hosts to victory." Lavish preparations were made to give the arriving trains a reception to remember. Chicagoans who lived on Michigan Avenue were asked to illuminate their houses. "A most magically beautiful effect was the result," one reporter noted, "the lights flashing back from and multiplied countlessly in the waters of the lakeshore basin." Thousands of spectators lined the shore of the lake, and as the trains moved along the pier, half-minute guns were fired by the Chicago Light Artillery, and rockets shot off from the foot of Jackson Street. No one present, the reporter observed, would forget the effect of artillery pealing, the flight of the rockets, the gleaming windows from the entire residence front of our city, the vast depot edifice filled with the eager crowd. Hotels and boarding house proprietors had spent weeks sprucing up their establishments. Private citizens were asked to open their homes, and restaurants promised hearty meals at low prices. The most popular luncheon in town included a glass of 4-year-old ale and a ham sandwich for 10 cents. As packed trains continued to steam into the thronged city, the number of eager Republican visitors on Chicago's streets climbed to 40,000. "I thought the city was crowded yesterday," one amazed reporter exclaimed on the day before the convention was set to open. "But it was as loose and comfortable as a last year's shoe beside the wedging and packing of today." The streets are full and appear very like conduits leading off the overflowings of the hotels, where huge crowds are constantly pouring out as if they were spouted up from below in some popular eruption. Even billiard rooms were enlisted to accommodate the staggering crowds. At a certain hour each evening, the games were brought to an abrupt halt, as mattresses were laid across the tables to create beds for the sleepy visitors. Looking in on one such establishment at midnight, a reporter saw 130 people stretched out on billiard tables, with a zest from the fatigues of the day that would have excited the sympathy of the most unfeeling bosom. "The city is thronged with Republicans," wrote the Chicago Evening Journal. "Republicans from the woods of Maine and the green valleys of all New England. Republicans from the Golden Gate and the old plantation. Republicans from everywhere. What seems a brilliant festival is but the rallying for a battle. It is an army with banners." Amid this murmur of the multitude, thought reverts to a time long past, the journal reminded readers, when a single car and one small chamber could have conveyed them all, when the anti-slavery principle that now blossoms white over the land was deemed the vision of enthusiasts, ridiculed, shunned, and condemned. By 1860, the Republican Party had clearly become the dominant force in Northern politics. Its growth and momentum had absorbed two parties, the Whigs and the Know-Nothings, and ruptured a third, the Democratic Party. If this new party could carry three of the four conservative northern states it had lost in 1856, Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, it could win the presidency. These battleground states lay along the southern tier of the North. They all bordered on slave states. They would play a decisive role in choosing a nominee. In the early hours of Wednesday, May 16th, the streets surrounding the newly built convention hall swarmed with excited citizens, who crowded around the doors and windows, congregated upon the bridge, sat on the curbstones, and, in fine, used every available inch of standing room. When the big doors of the wigwam, so-called, it was said, because the chiefs of the Republican Party were to meet there, were finally opened to the assembled multitude, thousands of ticket holders raced forward to fill the center seats and the more exclusive side galleries, where gentlemen were allowed only if accompanied by a lady. Desperate men had scoured the streets for women, schoolgirls, washerwomen, painted ladies, anyone wearing a skirt and willing to be their date for the afternoon. Within minutes, every seat and nook of the wigwam was occupied as 10,000 party members waited expectantly for the proceedings to begin. Exactly at noon, New York's Governor Edwin Morgan, chairman of the Republican National Committee, lowered his gavel and the convention officially began. In his opening address, Morgan told the cheering crowd that no body of men of equal number was ever clothed with greater responsibility than those now within the hearing of my voice. Let me then invoke you to act in a spirit of harmony, that by the dignity, the wisdom, and the patriotism displayed here, you may be enabled to enlist the hearts of the people and to strengthen them in their faith. The work of the convention began. In the course of the first 2 days, credential battles were settled, and an inclusive platform, keyed to northern interests, was enthusiastically adopted. While opposition to the extension of slavery remained as central as it had been in 1856, the 1860 platform also called for a Homestead Act, a protective tariff, a railroad to the Pacific, protection for naturalized citizens, and government support for harbor and river improvements, a far broader range of issues designed to attract a larger base. After much debate, the delegates rejected a provision requiring a two-thirds vote to secure the nomination. Their decision that a simple majority was sufficient to nominate appeared to be a victory for Seward. Coming into Chicago as the best known of all the contenders, he already had nearly a majority of pledges. The great body of ardent Republicans all over the country, James Pike observed, desired to elevate to the presidency the man who had begun so early and had labored so long in behalf of their cardinal doctrines. Indeed, when business came to a close at the end of the second day, a move was made to proceed directly to the presidential balloting. Had votes been cast at that moment, many believe, Seward would have emerged the victor. Instead, the secretary of the convention informed the delegates that the papers necessary for keeping the tally had not yet been prepared, and they adjourned until 10 o'clock the next morning. For those concerned that Seward was too radical on slavery and too liberal on immigration to win battleground states, Indiana, Illinois, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, the central question was whether the opposition could be unified behind one man. A committee of 12 was formed by the prominent representatives of the four critical states to see if a consensus could be reached. By 10 p.m., 12 hours before the balloting was set to begin, no one had been agreed upon. "The time has been consumed in talking," a member of the opposition committee lamented, as each delegation argued stubbornly for its favorite son. Shortly before midnight, Horace Greeley visited the committee to see if any agreement had been reached. Having surprised Weed by gaining entrance to the convention by representing Oregon as a proxy, Greeley planned to promote Bates and defeat Seward. Disappointed to learn that no agreement had been reached, Greeley sent a telegraph to the Tribune, concluding that since the opposition cannot concentrate on any candidate, Seward will be nominated. Murat Halstead of the Cincinnati Commercial telegraphed the same message to his paper at the same time, reporting that every one of the 40,000 men in attendance upon the Chicago Convention will testify that at midnight of Thursday to Friday night, the universal impression was that Seward's success was certain. In the rooms shared by the New York delegation, great cheers were heard. 300 bottles of champagne are said to have been cracked, reported Halstead. It flowed freely as water. Still, the night was young, the battle only just begun. As the hours passed, Weed must have sensed growing opposition among politicians in the conservative battleground states, many of whom feared that supporting Seward's candidacy would hurt their own chances in state elections. However, he never altered his original strategy. Before each delegation, he simply asserted that in this perilous time, Seward was, without question, the best man for the job. His love and devotion to his friend of more than 30 years blinded him to the inner dynamics at work since the convention began, the serious doubts that were surfacing about Seward's availability, which meant, bluntly, his ability to win. 4 years ago, we went to Philadelphia to name our candidate, Weed told one delegation after another, and we made one of the most inexcusable blunders. We nominated a man who had no qualification for the position of chief magistrate. We were defeated, as we probably deserved to be. We are facing a crisis. There are troublous times ahead of us. What this country will demand as its chief executive for the next 4 years is a man of the highest order of executive ability, a man of real statesmanlike qualities, well known to the country, and of large experience in national affairs. No other class of men ought to be considered at this time. We think we have, in Mr. Seward, just the qualities the country will need. We expect to nominate him, and to go before the country full of courage and confidence. No sooner did Weed leave each chamber than Horace Greeley came in and addressed the delegates. "I suppose they are telling you that Seward is the be-all and the end-all of our existence as a party, our great statesman, our profound philosopher, our pillar of cloud by day, our pillar of fire by night. But I want to tell you, boys, that in spite of all this, you couldn't elect Seward if you could nominate him. You must remember, as things stand today, we are a sectional party. We have no strength outside the North. Practically, we must have the entire North with us if we hope to win. He cannot carry New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Indiana, or Iowa, and I will bring to you representative men from each of these states who will confirm what I say." Greeley proceeded to do just that, one delegate recalled, introducing Governor Samuel Kirkwood of Iowa and gubernatorial candidates Andrew Curtin and Henry Lane of Pennsylvania and Indiana, each of whom confirmed what Greeley had said. "I know my people well," Pennsylvania's Henry Lane argued. "In the south half of my state, a good proportion of my people have come from slave states. They will not tolerate slavery in Indiana or in our free territories, but they will not oppose it where it is. They are afraid Seward would be influenced by that abolition element of the East and make war on slavery where it is." Greeley's spearheading of the anti-Seward forces was all the more credible because few were aware of his estrangement from Seward. Delegates accepted his arguments as those of a friend who simply feared Seward would not bring their party the presidency. "While professing so high a regard for Mr. Seward," one reporter later recognized, "there was rankling in the bosom of Greeley a hatred of the great statesman, as bitter as that ever entertained by the most implacable of his political enemies. The feeling had been pent up for years, gathering strength and fury for an occasion when a final explosion could be had with effect. The occasion was afforded at Chicago. The match was lit. The combustible material was ignited. The explosion came. Horace Greeley had his revenge." Nor was Seward the only target of the late-night gatherings. Gustav Kerner, the leader of the German Americans, an important component of the Republican constituency in the West, had never forgiven Bates for supporting Fillmore's Know-Nothing Party in 1856. In his memoirs, Kerner described rushing into a crowded meeting of delegates from Pennsylvania and Indiana. Frank Blair was just finishing an eloquent speech for Bates when Kerner took the floor. "In all candor," he said, "if Bates is nominated, even if he were to win his home state of Missouri, which was doubtful, the German Republicans in the other states would never vote for him. I, for one, would not, and I would advise my countrymen to the same effect." Bates was further handicapped by the fact that he never really represented the middle of the party, however much the Blairs and Greeley tried to position him there. He was much too conservative for liberal Republicans, who might welcome him into their party, but would never accord him chief command of an army in which he had never officially enlisted. At the same time, the letter he had written to prove his credentials to the Republicans had diminished the previous enthusiasm of conservatives and former know-nothings. Nor was all going well for Salmon Chase. Besides Seward, Chase was the most renowned Republican aspirant. Though more zealously committed to the black man than Seward, Chase was not hampered by Seward's radical reputation. His words had not become emblazoned on the banner of the anti-slavery movement. In contrast to Seward's reputation as a liberal spender, which hurt in battleground states, he was an economic conservative. And unlike Seward, he had never openly attacked the Know-Nothings. Moreover, as the third largest delegation at the convention, Ohio wielded substantial power. "If united," observed Halstead, "it would have a formidable influence and might throw the casting votes between candidates, holding the balance of power between the East and the West." But Ohio would not unite behind Chase, as some delegates held out for Ben Wade or Judge McLean. The many enemies Chase had made and failed to conciliate over the years came back to haunt him at this critical juncture. Any hope of persuading McLean to turn over his votes had been lost long before as a consequence of his manipulations to gain his Senate seat. Chase, McLean remarked, is selfish beyond any other man, and I know from the bargain he has made in being elected to the Senate, he is ready to make any bargain to promote his interest. There was no unity of action, no determination of purpose, one Chase supporter later lamented. There was a weakness in the spinal column in the Ohio delegation at Chicago, most pitiable to behold. Ohio's inability to settle firmly on Chase, another delegate told him, proved catastrophic. If the Ohio delegation had been true, you would have been nominated. I mingled freely with many of the delegations. They stood ready as a second choice to give you their votes. Would have done so if Ohio had been relied upon. Nor had Chase learned from his mistakes 4 years earlier. Once again, he failed to appoint a set of trusted managers who could guide his campaign, answer objections, cajole wavering delegates, and, at the right moment, make promises to buoy supporters and strengthen wills. "There are lots of good feeling afloat here for you," one of Chase's friends told him, "but there is no set of men in earnest for you. I think the hardest kind of death to die is that occasioned by indecisive or lukewarm friends." Meanwhile, throughout this night of a thousand knives, the opposition to Seward grew more vociferous, even frantic. "Men gather in little groups," observed Halsted, "and with their arms about each other, and chatter and whisper as if the fate of the country depended upon their immediate delivery of the mighty political secrets with which their imaginations are big." Rumors multiplied with each passing hour. Things of incalculable moment are communicated to you confidentially at intervals of 5 minutes. The rumor was deliberately circulated that the Republican candidates for governor in Indiana, Illinois, and Pennsylvania would resign if Seward were nominated. No one challenged Seward's ability. No one questioned his credentials as statesman of the party. He was opposed simply because it was thought he would damage the prospects of the Republican Party and hurt Republican candidates in local elections. Still, Halsted admiringly observed, "Amid all these cries of distress, the Sewardites are true as steel to their champion, and they will cling to old Irrepressible, as they call him, until the last gun is fired and the big bell rings." All along, the main question among the gathering ranks of the Stop Seward movement had been whether the opposition would be able to concentrate its strength on a single alternative, or be crippled by its own divisions. For this eventuality, Lincoln had long prepared. Though he understood he could not positively count on the unanimous support of any delegation beyond Illinois, he knew he had earned widespread respect and admiration throughout the North. "You know how it is in Ohio," he wrote a friend from the Buckeye State 2 weeks before the convention. "I am certainly not the first choice there, and yet I have not heard that anyone makes any positive objection to me. It is just so everywhere, so far as I can perceive. Everywhere except in Illinois, and possibly Indiana. One or another is preferred to me, but there is no positive objection." To reach his goal of becoming everyone's second choice, Lincoln was careful not to disparage any other candidate, nor was it in his nature to do so. His committed team of workers, including Judge David Davis, Leonard Swett, Norman Judd, and Stephen Logan, understood this, resolving from the start to antagonize no one. They did not need to, for Greeley and candidates for governor in the doubtful states had that task well in hand. Nor, as Kenneth Stamp writes, did they need to win support based upon Lincoln's relative ability compared with other candidates. Their appeal was based on availability and expediency. They urged the delegates to nominate the man who could win. "No men ever worked as our boys did," Swett later claimed. "I did not, the whole week I was there, sleep 2 hours a night." Although some of Lincoln's men had political ambitions of their own, Henry Whitney observed, "most of them worked con amore, chiefly from love of the man, his lofty moral tone, his pure political morality." Working in his typically methodical way, Davis designated specific tasks to each member of his team. Maine's Leonard Swett was charged with making inroads in the Maine delegation. Samuel Parks, a native Vermonter, was dispatched to the delegation of the Green Mountain State. In the spring elections in New England, the Republicans had suffered setbacks, leading Lincoln to observe that the election result would be seen as a drawback upon the prospects of Governor Seward, opening the door for one of his rivals. Stephen Logan and Richard Yates were given Kentucky, while Ward Lemon was assigned his home state of Virginia. In each of these states, the Lincoln men worked to pick off individual delegates to keep Seward from sweeping the field on the first ballot. "It all worked to a charm," boasted Swett. "The first state approached was Indiana." Even before the convention had opened, Lincoln got word that the whole of Indiana might not be difficult to get, and had urged Davis to concentrate on the Hoosier state. Though Indiana contained 20,000 or more former know-nothings, who likely preferred Bates, the Indiana politicians were fearful that Bates was not strong enough to challenge Seward for the nomination. And if Seward headed the ticket, gubernatorial candidate Henry Lane never tired of warning, the radical image he projected, and his unpopularity with the know-nothings, would jeopardize the entire state ticket. Claims have been made that Davis made a deal with Indiana's chairman, Caleb Smith, to bring him into the cabinet in return for Indiana's vote. No deal was needed, however. Smith had admired Lincoln since their days in Congress and had agreed, even before the balloting, to second Lincoln's nomination. The Indiana delegates' decision to back Lincoln on the first ballot was more likely a practical decision based on the best interests of their own state. By securing Indiana's pledge, the Lincoln men gained a decided advantage in the Committee of 12, which had remained deadlocked at midnight in its attempts to agree on a common candidate to oppose Seward, prompting Greeley and Halstead to predict a Seward victory. As the committee members continued to talk in the early morning hours, someone proposed a straw vote to determine the opposition candidate with the greatest strength. In this impromptu poll, since Lincoln already had the support of both Illinois and Indiana, two of the four key states, he emerged as the strongest candidate. According to one committee member, "Mr. Dudley of New Jersey then proposed that for the general good of the party, Pennsylvania should give up its favorite son after the first ballot, as would New Jersey. The proposition was generally agreed upon, but Pennsylvania required further negotiations to ratify the agreement." According to Henry Whitney, Davis had previously sent a telegram to Lincoln informing him that if Cameron were promised a space in the cabinet, Pennsylvania might be procured. Lincoln scribbled his answer in the margin of a newspaper, which an emissary carried to the convention. "Make no contracts that will bind me." When the message arrived, Whitney writes, "Everybody was mad, of course. Here were men working night and day to place him on the highest mountain peak of fame, and he pulling back all he knew how. What was to be done?" The bluff Dubois said, "Damn Lincoln." the polished sweat said in mellifluous accents, I am very sure if Lincoln was aware of the necessities. The critical Logan expectorated viciously and said, the main difficulty with Lincoln is... Herndon ventured, now, friend, I'll answer that. But Davis cut the Gordian knot by brushing all aside with, Lincoln ain't here, and don't know what we have to meet. So we will go ahead as if we hadn't heard from him, and he must ratify it. Moreover, Davis undoubtedly understood that other candidates were making pledges of their own. The Blairs had supposedly promised Cassius Clay the post of Secretary of War if he would endorse Bates, and doubtless Weed could promise not only cabinet posts, but the oceans of money he had accumulated for the Republican cause. Nonetheless, Davis's biographer concludes that no direct pledge was ever made to Cameron. Davis promised only that he would get every member of the Illinois delegation to recommend Cameron's appointment, which the Cameron men mistook for a guaranteed pledge. Whether or not explicit deals were made, the Lincoln men worked hard to convince Cameron's contingent that Pennsylvania would be treated generously if Lincoln received their votes. My assurance to them, Sweat later wrote Lincoln, was that despite the fact that Pennsylvania had not supported Lincoln from the start, they should be placed upon the same footing as if originally they had been your friends. Now, of course, it is unpleasant for me to write all this stuff and for you to read it. Of course, I have never feared you would unintentionally do anything unfair towards these men. I only write to suggest the very delicate situation I am placed towards them so that you might cultivate them as much as possible. By adding the votes of Indiana, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, three of the four doubtful states, to those of Illinois, Davis and Sweat had achieved what many considered impossible. They had made possible the nomination of Abraham Lincoln. As the day of the balloting dawned, the Seward men, confident of victory, gathered at the Richmond House for a celebratory march to the convention hall. 1,000 strong, Murat Halstead observed, and accompanied by a magnificent band, which was brilliantly uniformed, epaulettes shining on their shoulders, they prolonged their march a little too far. Upon reaching the wigwam, they were dismayed to find that some of their number could not get in. Lincoln's partisans had manufactured duplicate tickets the evening before, and had filed into the hall as soon as the doors opened. Recognizing that it was part of the Seward plan to carry the convention by bringing more supporters to Chicago than any other candidate, Lincoln's managers had mustered friends and supporters from all over the state. The nominations became the initial test of strength. New York's William Everts was the first to rise, asking the convention to place Seward's name in nomination. His words were met by a deafening shout. The applause was long and loud, as supporters continued to stand, waving handkerchiefs in frenzied excitement. Lincoln's man, Leonard Sweat, confessed that the level of enthusiasm appalled us a little. Nonetheless, Lincoln's contingent was ready when Norman Judd placed the name of Illinois's favorite son in nomination. If Mr. Seward's name drew forth thunders of applause, one reporter noted, what can be said of the enthusiastic reception of Lincoln's name? The audience, like a wild colt with a bit between his teeth, rose above all cry of order, and again the irrepressible applause broke forth and resounded far and wide. To Seward's supporters, this tremendous applause was the first distinct impression in Lincoln's favor. Though Chase and Bates were also nominated to loud applause, the responses were cold when compared to the receptions for Seward and Lincoln. When the seconding nominations proceeded, the trial of lungs intensified. Determined to win the battle, Seward's adherents rallied when Austin Blair of Michigan rose to second his nomination. The shouting was absolutely frantic, Halstead reported. No Comanches, no Panthers ever struck a higher note or gave screams with more infernal intensity. Once again, the Lincoln men rose to the challenge. When Indiana's Caleb Smith seconded Lincoln's nomination, 5,000 people at once jumped to their feet, Leonard Swett reported. 1,000 steam whistles, 10 acres of hotel gongs might have mingled in the scene unnoticed. A voice rose from the crowd. Abe Lincoln has it by the sound. Let us ballot. The efforts of Lincoln's men to corral more supporters had paid off. This was not the most deliberate way of nominating a president, Swett later confessed, but it had its weight. The convention finally settled down, and the balloting began. 233 votes would decide the Republican presidential nomination. The roll call opened with the New England states, which had been considered solidly for Seward. In fact, a surprising number of votes went for Lincoln, as well as a scattering for Chase. Lincoln's journey through New England after the Cooper Union speech had apparently won over a number of delegates. As expected, New York gave its full 70 votes to Seward, allowing him to leap far ahead. The Seward men relaxed until Virginia, which had also been considered solid for Seward, split its 22 votes between Seward and Lincoln. Chase had assumed that Ohio, which came next, would give him its full 46 votes, but the delegation was divided in its vote, giving 34 to Chase and the remaining 12 to Lincoln and McLean. Perhaps the greatest surprise was Indiana, which Bates had assumed was his territory. Instead, Lincoln gathered all 26 votes. This solid vote was a startler, reported Halstead, and the keen little eyes of Henry S. Lane glittered as it was given. At the end of the first ballot, the tally stood: Seward, 173.5, Lincoln, 102, Chase, 49, Bates, 48. The Bates managers were downhearted to realize, as the historian Marvin Kane writes, that no pivotal state had gone for Bates, and the sought-after votes of the Iowa, Kentucky, Minnesota, and Ohio delegations had not been delivered. Disappointment was equally evident in the faces of the Chase men, for they were keenly aware that the division within the Ohio delegation was probably fatal. Lincoln's camp was exhilarated, for with his total of 102 votes, Lincoln had emerged as the clear-cut alternative to Seward. Although taken aback by the unexpected defections, Weed still hoped that Seward would win on the second ballot. The 48 votes Cameron had supposedly promised from Pennsylvania would put Seward within striking distance of the victory number of 233. The second ballot revealed a crucial shift in Lincoln's favor. In New England, he picked up 17 more votes, while Delaware switched its 6 votes from Bates to Lincoln. Then came the biggest surprise of all, startling the vast auditorium like a clap of thunder. Pennsylvania announced 44 votes for Lincoln, boosting his total to 181, only 3.5 votes behind Seward's new total of 184.5. Chase and Bates both lost ground on the second ballot, essentially removing them from contention. The race had narrowed to Seward and Lincoln. Tension in the wigwam mounted. The spectators sat on the edge of their seats as the third ballot began. Lincoln gained 4 additional votes from Massachusetts and 4 from Pennsylvania, also adding 15 votes from Ohio. His total reached 231.5, only 1.5 votes shy of victory. There was a pause, Halstead recorded. In about 10 ticks of a watch, David K. Carter of Ohio stood and announced the switch of 4 votes from Chase to Lincoln. A profound stillness fell upon the wigwam, one eyewitness wrote. Then the Lincoln supporters, rose to their feet, applauding rapturously, the ladies waving their handkerchiefs, the men waving and throwing up their hats by thousands, cheering again and again. For the Sewardites, the defeat was devastating. "Great men wept like boys," one New Yorker observed, faces drawn, white and aged as if 10 years had passed in that one night of struggle. Everyone looked to Thurlow Weed, but there was no solace he could give. The work of his lifetime had ended in defeat, and he too could not restrain his tears. His failure to serve his country by making his good friend president, Weed later acknowledged, was the great disappointment of his life. All across the chamber, representatives rose, clamoring to change their votes so that Lincoln could achieve a unanimous victory. Their emotional tone revealed that the defeated Seward still had a great hold on their hearts. When Michigan shifted its votes to Lincoln, Austin Blair confessed that his state was laying down her first best-loved candidate, with some bleeding of the heart, with some quivering in the veins. But she does not fear that the fame of Seward will suffer, for his story will be written and read and beloved long after the temporary excitement of this day has passed away, and when presidents are themselves forgotten. In similar fashion, Carl Schurz of Wisconsin predicted that Seward's ambition would be fulfilled with the success of the cause which was the dream of his youth, and that his name would remain in history an instance of the highest merit uncrowned with the highest honor. The most poignant moment came when New York's chairman, William Evarts, stood up. Mounting a table, with grief manifest in his countenance, his hands clenched nervously, he delivered a powerful tribute to Seward. "Gentlemen, it was from Governor Seward that most of us learned to love Republican principles and the Republican Party." He finally requested that New York shift its votes to Lincoln. So moving was his speech, one reporter noted, that the spectator could not fail to be impressed with the idea that a man who could have such a friend must be a noble man indeed. Once the vote was made unanimous, the celebration began in earnest. A man stationed on the roof of the wigwam shouted the news of Lincoln's nomination, along with that of Hannibal Hamlin of Maine for vice president, to the thousands waiting on the street. Cannons were fired, and between 20,000 and 30,000 outside were yelling and shouting at once. The festivities continued through the night. "The Press and Tribune building," one of the paper's reporters wrote, "was illuminated from turret to foundation by the brilliant glare of 1,000 lights which blazed from windows and doors." Shouldering the symbolic fence rails that Lincoln had supposedly split, Republicans paraded through the streets to the music of 12 bands. Seward received the news of his loss while sitting with friends in his country garden at Auburn. A rider on a swift horse had waited at the telegraph office to dash through the crowded streets the moment a telegram arrived. When the totals of the first ballot came in, the messenger had galloped to Seward's house and handed the telegram to him. When the news of Seward's large lead was repeated to guests at his house and to the crowds on the street, great cheers went up. When the totals of the second ballot came in, Seward retained his optimism. "I shall be nominated on the next ballot," he predicted to the boisterous audience on the lawn, and a great cheer resounded from the streets. Long, anxious moments followed. When no further news arrived, Seward rightly judged that there was no news that friends would love to bring. Finally, the unwelcome telegram announcing Lincoln's nomination on the third ballot arrived. Seward turned as pale as ashes. He understood at once, as did his supporters, his son Fred would remember, that it was no ordinary political defeat, to be retrieved in some subsequent campaign. It was final and irrevocable. The sad tidings crept through the vast concourse, one reporter noted. The flags were furled, the cannon was rolled away, and Cayuga County went home with a clouded brow. Later that night, writing in his diary in Washington, Charles Francis Adams could not stop thinking of his defeated friend, of his sanguine expectations, of his long services, of his large and comprehensive philosophy, and of his great ambition, all now merged for a time in a deep abyss of disappointment. He has too much of alloy in his composition to rise above it. Few men can. Yet he took the blow as a champion should, his biographer notes, putting on a brave front before his family and the world. In her diary, 16-year-old Fanny Seward noted simply that Father told Mother and I, in three words, Abraham Lincoln nominated. His friends feel much distress. He alone has a smile. He takes it with philosophical and unselfish coolness. Informed that the editor of the local evening paper could find no one in the disconsolate town willing to write and comment on the news announcing Lincoln and Hamlin's nominations, Seward took up his own pen. No truer or firmer defenders of the Republican faith could have been found in the Union, he graciously stated, than the distinguished and esteemed citizens on whom the honors of the nomination have fallen. Before he retired that night, Seward wrote to Weed, "You have my unbounded gratitude for this last, as for the whole life of efforts in my behalf. I wish that I were sure that your sense of the disappointment is as light as my own." A week later, in a public letter, Seward pledged his support to the Republican ticket and said he hoped his friends, who had labored so long by his side, would not allow their sense of disappointment to hinder or delay the progress of that cause. Beneath his graceful facade, Seward was angry, hurt, and humiliated. It was only some months later, the biographer Glendon Van Dusen writes, when the shock had worn off and hope of a sort had revived, that he could say, half ruefully, half whimsically, how fortunate it was that he did not keep a diary, for if he had, there would be a record of all his cursing and swearing when the news arrived. If Seward managed to project a willed equanimity, Chase could not hide his bitterness at his defeat, nor his fury at the Ohio delegation that had failed to support him unanimously. When I remember what New York did for Seward, what Illinois did for Lincoln, and what Missouri did for Bates, Chase told a friend, and remember also that neither of these gentlemen ever spent a fourth part, if indeed a tithe of the time, labor, and means for the Republican Party in their respective states that I have spent for our party in Ohio, and then reflect on the action of the Ohio delegation in Chicago towards me, I confess I have little heart to write or think about it. I must say that had Senator Ben Wade received the same expression from Ohio which was given to me, and had I been in his place, I would have suffered my arm to be wrenched from my body before I would have allowed my name to be brought into competition with his. For years, Chase was racked by the thought that had Ohio remained loyal, he would have won the nomination. Even in a congratulatory letter to Lincoln, he could not refrain from citing his own situation. Supposing that the adhesion of the Illinois delegation yielded Lincoln a higher gratification even than the nomination itself, Chase confessed that the perfidy of his own delegation was unbearable. "In this, I am quite sure you must participate," he sounded Lincoln, "for I err greatly in my estimate of your magnanimity if you do not condemn, as I do, the conduct of delegates from whatever state who disregard the clearly expressed preference of their own state convention." Lincoln responded graciously, without taking the bait. Carl Schurz contemplated Chase's torment in the dark hours following the nomination. "While the victory of Mr. Lincoln was being announced to the outside world," he wrote, "my thoughts involuntarily turned to Chase, who, I imagined, sat in a quiet office room at Columbus with a telegraph nearby clicking the news from Chicago. Not even his own state had given him its full strength. No doubt he had hoped and hoped and hoped against hope. And now came this disastrous, crushing, humiliating defeat. I saw that magnificent man before me, writing with the agony of his disappointment, and I sympathized with him most profoundly." As the news of Chase's defeat filtered into the streets of Columbus, the dray, readied to haul the cannon to the corner of 3rd and State Streets to announce his victory with a roar of thunder, was used instead to honor Lincoln's nomination. After the short, melancholy ceremony was concluded, the dray hauled the cannon back to its shed, and the city went to sleep. Bates accepted defeat with the composure that had marked his character from the outset. "As for me, I was surprised, I own, but not at all mortified at the result at Chicago," he wrote Greeley. "I had no claim, literally none, upon the Republicans as a party, and no right to expect their party honors. And I shall cherish with enduring gratitude the recollection of the generous confidence with which many of their very best men have honored me. So far from feeling beaten and depressed, I have cause rather for joy and exultation. For by the good opinion of certain eminent Republicans, I have gained much in standing and reputation before the country. More, I think, than any mere private man I have ever known." In his private journal, however, Bates admitted to a sense of irritation. "Some of my friends who attended the convention assure me that the nomination of Mr. Lincoln took everybody by surprise, that it was brought about by accident or trick, by which my pledged friends had to vote against me. The thing was well planned and boldly executed. A few Germans, Schurz of Wisconsin and Kerner of Illinois, with their truculent boldness, scared the timid men of Indiana into submission. Kerner went before the Indiana delegation and assured them that if Bates were nominated, the Germans would bolt. The platform," he continued, "is exclusive and defiant, not attracting but repelling assistance from without. It lugs in the lofty generalities of the Declaration of Independence, for no practical object that I can see, but needlessly exposing the party to the specious charge of favoring Negro equality. I think they will soon be convinced, if they are not already, that they have committed a fatal blunder. They have denationalized their party, weakened it in the free states, and destroyed its hopeful beginnings in the border slave states." While the melancholy spirit of defeated expectations settled upon the streets of Auburn, Columbus, and St. Louis, Springfield was euphoric. The legendary moment when Lincoln learned of his nomination has spawned many versions over the years. Some claim Lincoln was standing in a shop, purchasing some items that Mary had requested, when cheers were heard from the telegraph office, followed by the shouts of a boy rushing through the crowd, "Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln, you are nominated." Others maintain that he was talking with friends in the office of the Illinois State Journal when he received the news. Handed the scrap of paper that reported his victory, he looked at it long and silently, not heeding the noisy exultation of all around. Shaking hands with everyone in the room, he remarked quietly, "I knew this would come when I saw the second ballot." Leaving the journal office, Lincoln plunged into a crowd of well-wishers on the street. "My friends," he said, "I am glad to receive your congratulations. And as there is a little woman down on 8th Street who will be glad to hear the news, You must excuse me until I inform her. When he reached his home, Ida Tarbell reports, he found that Mary already knew that the honor which for 20 years and more she had believed and stoutly declared her husband deserved, at last had come. The tumult in Springfield that evening was recorded by a young journalist, John Hay, who would later become Lincoln's aide. He reported that the hearty Western populace burst forth in the wildest manifestations of joy. Lincoln banners, decked in every style of rude splendor, fluttered in the high west wind. The church bells tolled. Thousands assembled in the rotunda of the Capitol for a festive celebration replete with victory speeches. When the meeting adjourned, the happy throngs converged on Lincoln's house. His appearance at the door was the signal for immense cheering. Modestly, Lincoln insisted that he did not suppose the honor of such a visit was intended particularly for himself as a private citizen, but rather as the representative to a great party. For generations, people have weighed and debated the factors that led to Lincoln's surprising victory. Many have agreed with the verdict of Murat Halstead, who wrote that the fact of the convention was the defeat of Seward rather than the nomination of Lincoln. Seward himself seemed to accept this analysis. When asked, years later, why Lincoln had won, he said, "The leader of a political party in a country like ours is so exposed that his enemies become as numerous and formidable as his friends." Abraham Lincoln, by contrast, comparatively unknown, had not to contend with the animosities generally marshaled against a leader. There is truth to this argument, but it tells only part of the story, for the question remains, why was Lincoln the beneficiary of Seward's downfall, rather than Chase or Bates? Some have pointed to luck, to the fact that Lincoln lived in a battleground state the Republicans needed to win, and to the fact that the convention was held in Chicago, where the strength of local support could add weight to his candidacy. Had the convention been held at any other place, Kerner admitted, Lincoln would not have been nominated. Others have argued that he was positioned perfectly in the center of the party. He was less radical than Seward or Chase, but less conservative than Bates. He was less offensive than Seward to the Know-Nothings, but more acceptable than Bates to the German-Americans. Still others have argued that Lincoln's team in Chicago played the game better than anyone else, conceiving the best strategy and cleverly using the leverage of promises to the best advantage. Without doubt, the Lincoln men, under the skillful leadership of David Davis, performed brilliantly. Chance, positioning, and managerial strategy all played a role in Lincoln's victory. Still, if we consider the comparative resources each contender brought to the race, their range of political skills, their emotional, intellectual, and moral qualities, their rhetorical abilities, and their determination and willingness to work hard, it is clear that when opportunity beckoned, Lincoln was the best prepared to answer.